The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices for Justice and Radical Healing. From Tuesday, October 6th through October 15th, streaming online. Voices for Justice and Radical Healing is an online speaker series in support of Living Yoga's trauma-informed services. Speakers will explore ways to create healing for individuals, systems, and culture through body-based practices. Again, that's Voices for Justice and Radical Healing from Tuesday, October 6th through October 15th, streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Rape, an intergenerational discussion about race, with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
Come on.
Let's talk about rape. Baby, let's talk about you.
Race. Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race. On this edition of Let's Talk About Race, we explore the physical violence occurring in the streets as various protesters clash, and the psychological violence from Trump as he occupies the White House, controls the Republican Party, and normalizes white supremacy. All this is occurring during a time of worldwide calls for racial justice in the middle of an airborne pandemic that has killed over 200,000 Americans. What is going on in America today?
Mother, mother, there's too many of you. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today.
this is going on in America today.
What we know so far is that there was a large caravan demonstration gathering just in the suburbs of Portland yesterday afternoon. Organizers say there were about 3,000 people, about 600 vehicles. Many of them had Trump flags, and this was supposed to be a demonstration to show support for President Trump in and around the Portland area, where there has been so much criticism of the president, and there have been very significant protests in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. Portland, of course, has been the scene where federal agents were sent in to try and calm those protests, only really making those tensions even worse, making the scene even more raw. But in that situation yesterday, those pro-Trump supporters, they were confronted by some supporters of the Black Lives Matter movement before they even hit the road, and there were tensions that were very clear from the very beginning. As the caravan made its way through the city, it was not supposed to actually go to the downtown area where there have been those protests, but some of the pro-Trump supporters did go into the city, and when they went into the city, they were met by Black Lives Matter activists and sympathizers and supporters. And you can see social media video of people on the street throwing things at the pro-Trump supporters, as well as people from that pro-Trump movement. They are actually firing tear gas at the supporters. And we do have one video from a New York Times reporter, and we can bring it up. And that video shows people in a pro-Trump vehicle, a truck, sitting in the back of the truck, having a paintball gun, firing paintballs at those people on the street. So there were fist fights in the street. There were clashes. And this was sort of the scene that was taking place in different spots all over downtown Portland when there was some sort of altercation and someone was shot and killed.
And we're talking about violence in the street. Here in Portland, Oregon, a Trump supporter was shot. And the person that shot him went to Washington State and got in a police shootout and was shot by the police. I can't make this up. This is actually what's happening in America today. Let's talk about the violence on the streets. Let's start with Professor Johnson. Professor Johnson, tell us about the violence in the streets.
Well, I think we've seen an eruption of violence all across the country. It tends to be a part of what happens with social injustice and the unrest. We've seen it on the coast, on both coasts. And I think Portland, Oregon has sort of become the poster for, I guess, violence and looting and those things that have accompanied the Black Lives Matter protests. But what concerns me is that there are many different groups involved in this that are perpetuating this violence, but it all seems to get laid at the feet of Black Lives Matter. And I don't believe that Black Lives Matter is involved in a lot of this violence, but I believe they're getting tarnished. Their work and their efforts is being tarnished by the media sort of talking about it in a vague way where people construe, or either they directly put it at the feet of Black Lives Matter.
Cecil, what do you think? Violence in the street in America.
I think we need to change how we address this issue. When we talk about violence in the streets in America, we need first to remember the source of violence. And for many of us, it's the militarized policing. That was the origin of much of the uprise throughout the nations. So when we talk about violence and how to end violence, we must remember why people started going into the streets. And that was because Black bodies were being destroyed by police. Now, to end violence, it's simple, I think, is to change, to defund the police. We want to end violence in the streets. We need to end policing as we know it.
And that's what you mean by defund the police, just ending policing as we know it, as an occupying force in inner cities and throughout America. Is that what you mean, Cecil?
Yes, indeed. The way community safety is addressed, we need to re-envision what that means. And the way we've been doing it and the way we have been doing it is not working, has not worked. And too many communities, oppressed communities, are feeling the brutal force of the police.
Althea.
Yeah, I'd like to echo what Cecil said. I think
the sense that the protests are out of control, which would compel white nationalists to drive down the street with giant guns and enact what we saw on the street in Portland and in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that is grounded in this sense of like a lack of control and that things are out of control, but that itself is sort of born out of the media conflating property damage and physical violence. And that's something that we've talked about on this show and is talked about around the Black Lives Matter movement, especially when journalists are covering protests. There is something sensational about throwing a glass bottle at a building or the graffiti of it, but that leads to this sense and this conflation of that property damage is severe and means something on the scale of what people are protesting for and what people are protesting against, which is physical violence enacted by the police on Black and brown bodies. And so in that sense, who can take up the cause if the police are not able to quash the sentiment of the people who are being oppressed by this system? It's the white nationalists who and militia people who are opportunists in this moment and think of themselves as being able to offer some kind of order or some kind of vigilante justice that to them makes sense and is justified.
Nia Gray, Faith Reporter, violence in America.
Well, I think we've seen an escalation. I remember when the riots first, excuse me, not the riots, either got me saying that, when the protests first started, that there would just be individuals out confronting protesters, you know, telling them your life doesn't matter, or all lives matter, or blue lives matter. And every once in a while, you get some vandalism where people would go and try to erase or paint over the Black Lives Matter murals that were painted on the streets of major cities. And now it's just escalated to violence. And it's because Trump seems to support this right-wing vigilante violence. There's definitely a double standard where armed white militia can go out and confront protesters, can shoot protesters, but the white militia is considered patriarch. They're patriots, right? They're fighters for freedom. When you look at protesters, like Althea said, when you look at them, it's just chaos and it's destruction. So he is normalizing the violence against protesters, African-American protesters or peaceful protesters for Black Lives Matter and other protests that are going on. And you see it in Kenosha and you see it in Portland, Oregon, where he actually tweeted out condolences, not to the African-American men who were murdered by the police, but to the right-wing vigilante who was killed. And also never wanting to point fingers at the Kenosha killer, right? It's not his fault. Somebody must have done something. He was acting in self-defense.
So sticking with the whole theme of violence in America in 2020, we have valid protests from the Black Lives Matter movement and their allies. We have opportunist people taking advantage of these protests, engaging in violence, and then we have petty criminals engaging in whatever they can take in terms of the looting. Does this image in America in the summer and fall of 2020, does it hurt the Biden campaign? I want to start with Cecil.
I think it's interesting that the president is saying that if Mr. Biden is elected, you're going to have all this violence and rioting and things are going to run amok, when in fact all of this is happening while he is president. You know, it is as if there's a disconnect. This violence and eruption and the protests is happening because of people in charge, such as Mr. Trump. And if we are going to point any fingers, we must ask, why is it now that under the so-called law and order president, you have so much protest and eruption in communities throughout the nation. I think if Mr. Biden is wise, he and Senator Harris should continue to point out that Mr. Trump and his supporters are the reason why we are in this terrible condition, and that this election should be an election about whether or not we are satisfied with the way things are, and Mr. Trump should be held accountable.
So, Nia Gray, in Pennsylvania, they're advertising happening that states, if you call the police in the Biden administration, the police are not going to come. They're going to be defunded. Crime will run rampant. Does the protests that are occurring in the streets in 2020 hurt the Biden campaign? And if so, how does it?
So you're correct. They do have those attack ads, the pro-Trump ads from different lobbies and also directly from his campaign. There's a new one from the NRA where there's a young woman and there's kind of three shady guys around her car. She goes to reach for a gun that's actually just sitting there on the seat, which I don't even think that's legal. And it disappears because it says in Joe Biden's America, if he wins, then you won't have access to your guns. That's exactly the message that resonated in Pennsylvania. I remember people who voted for Trump said that they thought Hillary Clinton was going to take away their guns. So they're just perpetuating the same lies or using fear. The older lady, somebody's breaking in her house. She's watching the protests on television. It also has a quote that I've seen in different stories, news articles, it's gone national, where it incorrectly says that Joe Biden supports defunding the police. And I can't find where there's a quote where he actually said that. So they're just using those scare tactics here. And the polls say that Biden is ahead. We know national polls are not very accurate, but when I talk to people in Pennsylvania, it's all about the police being defunded and sort of the fear that the suburbs are going to be attacked or the suburbs are going to disappear. So I do think that they're having an effect in Pennsylvania. I believe that Biden and Kamala need to come out and actually have a plan to solve this problem. Maybe they come out and say, stop the protests, because when I'm elected, within the first 30 days, we're going to come up with plan, blah, 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 like fill in the blanks. And to explain, Biden needs to explain that it's not just a few bad apples. That's the other thing that I talk to people about in church and my neighbors, that they perceive violence, law enforcement violence towards African American men as being sort of these random acts, that those are a few bad cops, bad things happen, where African Americans and people that understand what's going on know that this is systemic racism. And I agree with Cecil, this whole defund, John and I were talking about it when we saw those signs defund and we go, yep, I don't think that's the right message. Although we understand what they mean, other folks don't. I would consider it reimagine what law enforcement can be in this country. I saw an interesting story on MSNBC that said that the United States police kill civilians at much higher rates than other countries. So not the countries that are executing people. I think there's a country in Africa that had 30 executions. But if that's what we're like comparing ourselves to, is that we need to reimagine law enforcement in this country. And Joe Biden needs to come up with a plan to explain that to the voters before Election Day.
Althea, news director of KBOO Radio, what do you think? Violence in the street in America, is it helping or hurting the Biden campaign?
Well, I think Trump's response to it has painted the Biden campaign into a tough spot. Cecil and Nia kind of touched on that idea of the law and order candidate. And I went back to look at where did that idea originate, and it was Nixon who first brought that idea to the forefront, actually as a way to distinguish himself from the much more obviously racist candidate George Wallace, who was a third party candidate at that time. And he reasoned at that time that crime, the idea of crime, is a proxy for other anxieties, and so there was a way to talk about these things to the silent majority and, you know, middle America, that was a coded racial anxiety. Now, to be fair, back when Nixon was running for office, the crime rate really was going up. Compare that to now, the rhetoric has come back around, even though the crime rate is way lower than it used to be. But going up against someone who is a quote-unquote law and order candidate, you're automatically, the opponent rather, is automatically painted into the corner, I should say, of being for chaos and anarchy. And it makes it really difficult to talk with nuance about a really nuanced issue. And I think when people hear law and order, I think that there are some people where bells go off in their head and they remember what it's code for. But if you don't know those codes, what might come to mind, if a dream of law and order is achieved, it might look like being able to walk down the street and not feel any kind of anxiety about where you're at or what might happen to you. And that if there was some breakdown in that, that there would be someone there to help you. But that idea or that desire could be created in so many different ways that don't have to involve the police. Maybe, you know, you use social services instead to bring about that kind of change, but that to bring that up in a space where someone else is claiming law and order, I think that is a tough sort of line to walk, and I don't think that we've seen them do it so successfully as of yet.
Thank you. Diane Johnson, Professor Johnson.
There's a couple of thoughts that I have about whether it's hurting Biden. There has been some research as to whether he actually supported the defund the police, but he has never said anything like that in any of the speeches or that I have observed. But I have to say that when I first heard that framed that way, I thought that was a very poorly framed construct and that it would give fuel to the opposing party by saying defund the police, because in reality, no one wants the police to cease to exist. And that's the way that is framed. It would have been much more important. And I felt, given that we had that opportunity, that focus with George Floyd and having people re-examine how the police were functioning, to have constructed that concept differently, like restructure or reimagine or turn it into something positive that we were going to do with the police. The other thing, I think that they were able to run with that and say, look, you want to defund the police? It feeds right into that. We've got chaos now, and I'm offering you law and order. So I think that we created an obstacle, or I should say, when I'm talking about we, I'm talking about people who are focused on social justice, we created our own obstacle to overcome, when it could have been an opportunity to frame it differently, frame it in a way that group of people who are afraid would see that it was actually a positive move in terms of reimagining the police, taking things like maybe things that belong in the social service arena, or for the example, the city of Austin, who's actually triaging 9/11 calls now, taking some away from police response, that we'd actually be helping the police to focus more on the work that we pay them to do. So that was my first comment. I think that Biden has come out with some good plans, but there is this element in our population that is afraid, and they are playing that very well. And I don't believe that we have a well thought out strategic response.
Cecil, you have a follow up comment?
I do. You know, two things. One, you know, and I don't think that Trump supporters go along with the facts, but here are some facts for other people. One is that under Obama and Biden, the crime rate was down. It is higher under Trump. Second, Vice President Biden said in in an opinion piece a few months ago, while I do not believe funding federal dollars should go to police departments violating people's rights or turning to violence as a first resort, I do not support defunding police. And indeed, he has been criticized by the left flank in his party, AOC and others, because he has not been more progressive on his viewing on policing. But those are a couple of observations, but facts don't seem to matter to many of the Trump supporters anyway.
So we are headed for some really difficult times, and I think we're headed for a race war. And a race war doesn't have to be so literal. The fact that you have Trump talking about snatching away the 1619 curriculum, forcing educational institutions to implement a curriculum that celebrates slave masters. It reminds me of, you have the Civil War, you had Reconstruction, then you had the Jim Crow era. Are we headed for another Jim Crow era? Cecil, what do you think?
Yes, Jim Crow 2 or 3 or 4. It continues.
Diane Johnson, Professor Johnson, what do you think?
I think we are in for a battle, and I think in large part it's fueled by demographics that are changing. Minorities are becoming majorities, and those that enjoyed majority are now becoming minorities, and also the shifting power that that represents. So yes, I would agree.
Nia Gray, what do you think about what I just said?
Sure. I think that there are a lot of things that are changing. There is a lot of disturbing news, but then also on some fronts, I'm seeing some glimpses of hope. For example, we have a group at our church that meets every 2 weeks, and we're talking about social justice issues that we can bring to the leadership at the church to start including in corporate messages about social justice. And then specifically in my corporation, we're actually auditing peer reviews and management reviews of people of color and also the gay and trans community that works for us to make sure that there's not any implicit bias. So it's interesting that on some front, I'm seeing, you know, sort of these narratives that are coming out of the executive office that are, you know, racist and dividing. But then also sort of within my own groups in corporate America, I'm seeing some progress being made. And also, when have we ever relied on what the public schools are teaching us about history? Right? I mean, whether it's the 1619 or the 1776, I think everybody on this phone, what we know because we've gone out and sought out the truth, looked it for our own sources, and that's just what we have to make sure that we share that and teach that to our friends, family, and community.
Althea, what do you think?
There is reckoning happening. There has been a progressive reckoning throughout America's history. I think there are signs of regressive attitudes that are really disturbing, that are informed by, as Professor Johnson mentioned, demographic change. But there also are things that have had major movement in the past few months that, you know, we haven't seen on that level, even in the course of the past 10 years. So there is a reckoning happening. There is a reckoning that is continuing. Whether it turns into widespread violence, I don't know.
All right. With that being said, let's talk about what we didn't talk about on this show. I'm going to start. We're talking about reimagining the police. I think what happened in Utah is a perfect example of where you have a mother with an out-of-control child who has some mental health issues, autism, and so forth. He's out of control. He's decompensating. The police come in, and within a few minutes, they shoot him. That's a perfect example of how another agency or another action force could have dealt with that problem without calling the police and their mentality to shoot first and ask questions later. So that's what we didn't talk about. The police continue to be a very poor response to people suffering mental health issues in this country. Nia, what didn't we talk about?
We did not talk about some of the Donald Trump bombshells that were dropped this week. First, calling the military folks who gave their lives in World War II, and also he's been known to call people who served in the military losers. And so that came out. And then also there's actually a tape of Donald Trump in an interview with Bob Woodward, where he actually knew about the coronavirus and the danger of it as early as February and decided to downplay it so that he wouldn't cause a panic.
Cecil, what didn't we talk about? And then Althea.
I think what we did not talk about is how we need to continue to center Black lives in this time in history. And I'm always drawn to the quote from Ella Baker, who said, until the killing of Black men, Black mothers' sons become as important to the rest of the country as the killing of a white mother's son. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until this happens. Black lives matter, and we need to keep talking about that. And not only Black men, but Black women, Black trans life, Black children, Black lives matter.
What we didn't talk about today is the exit of Kellyanne Conway from the administration, which is also interesting because her husband, George Conway, who was one of the founders of the Lincoln Project, has been very outspoken as adversaries for Trump, has left the Lincoln Project.
Now, you think they both left? I mean, it is quite amazing. She's for Trump, he's against Trump, and he's put his money where his mouth is. I love the Lincoln Project. I love the ads that they do. Was it more of a personal issue with their daughter on Instagram telling all their business?
I do think that there were some dynamics there that brought into question for their family, probably, their family dynamics. But since Kellyanne Conway did occupy a pretty highly placed advisory role in the administration, the feeling of her absence becomes important and what that will look like.
Althea?
One thing we didn't get the chance to talk about today was the way in which statistics and statistics about race can be misleading, can be weaponized or taken out of context in the sense that, well, put it to you this way, it can be used for a lot of different things. And oftentimes, statistics, science, is taken away from its original context to be a tool of oppression, especially since some statistical analysis go against our innate senses. And I think it'd be interesting to talk about that sometime.
Now, do you mean statistics that say Black people are intelligently or less intelligent than whites, those kinds of statistics, are more prone to violence, are on welfare more, those kinds of statistics?
I think there's medical statistics out there. There's a lot of bad faith studies as well that go back to a time with a lot less consensus in the scientific community about how these sorts of things should be studied. But also thinking about crime statistics and the way that those can be, you know, corrupted to someone's particular context and, you know, taken at face value with someone who's not prepared to engage deeply with that material can be used to justify something that doesn't logically match with the original source.
Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way.
Tonight, in what critics say is clearly a cornerstone of his re-election strategy, President Trump is threatening to send in federal law enforcement to stop surging violence in major cities from New York to Chicago.
Look at what's going on. All run by Democrats, all run by very liberal Democrats. And you know what? If Biden got in, that would be true for the country. The whole country would go to hell.
This is a game he's playing to divert attention away from the many crises that are facing this nation.
The Trump administration says it sent federal agents to Portland, Oregon to defend federal buildings against violent attacks, but the mayor there says that escalated the conflict. Now, mayors from six major cities are sending this letter to the Attorney General, blasting that deployment.
I'll be darned if I'm going to let anybody, even if their name is Mr. President, bring those kind of troops to our city.
Some legal experts are raising constitutional questions.
What's unprecedented is using federal law enforcement like this, that is to say, as a counter-protest force in contexts in which cities and states have said, we don't need them.
And new at 6:30, the U.S. Attorney General reportedly wanted to look into criminal charges for Seattle's mayor.
This evening, the New York Times reported that William Barr asked the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division to explore charging Mayor Jenny Durkan for letting protesters establish the Capitol Hill Occupied Protest Zone, or CHOP, back in June. A few blocks of Capitol Hill were barricaded for weeks this summer, as you'll remember, after police officers abandoned the East Precinct. The president repeatedly threatened both Mayor Durkan and Governor Jay Inslee with federal intervention. The article also alleges Barr asked authorities to explore sedition charges against violent protesters.
Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
This is Nia Gray, and welcome to the Faith Report, where evangelism meets social justice.
I've been lonely for so long. Don't seem like happiness will come along. I've been lonely for so long. Seem like happiness will come along.
Feeling lonely or isolated is a common experience during COVID-19, but surprisingly, for the past several years, loneliness has been on the rise. In fact, the UK appointed a Minister of Loneliness in 2018, who was tasked to lead the government to make loneliness a priority. So why is loneliness a priority in Britain? A recent survey showed that almost a fifth of the population, over 9 million people, say they were always or often lonely. And you might think of old people, shut-ins, but in this survey, younger people felt two times more lonely than those over 55 years old. Loneliness isn't just a social issue, it's a budding health crisis. Loneliness has been estimated to shorten a person's life by 15 years, equivalent in impact to being obese or smoking 15 cigarettes per day. And it's 2020, and Britain has currently been on its third Minister of Loneliness with no positive results. So it's not surprising that a post-religious UK, where more than half of the population surveyed say they have no religion, are experiencing isolation and loneliness. You know, God is a God of relationship and community. Therefore, being part of a religious group, you are scheduled to meet. You have different types of events, places to worship, times to attend. Where atheists may meet, their meetings are more sparse, and the non-religious don't organize meetups at all. But Christian groups can make people feel lonely too. Congregations can be insular or judgmental and exclude people on the basis of sexual orientation, gender, and economic status, causing Christians that even are part of a congregation and are involved in face-to-face fellowship, that they too can experience loneliness. But the community is designated to be a place of worship. Loneliness is surprisingly a symptom of an individualistic society. The me, not we. When human existence is disconnected from any higher power, therefore any responsibility for anyone other than ourselves,
It gives you a certain amount of freedom that you don't answer to anyone and you make your own rules to live by. And no accountability means you have a certain price to pay for this freedom. And the price you're paying for this no accountability, do what I want to do, when I want to do it, living for myself, is isolation, loneliness, and lacking any overall sense of purpose. In post-religious secular UK, it isn't hard to connect the dots of the high rates of loneliness to the rate of suicide in the country, which hit a tragic 16-year high. There are consequences that you pay for the perspective that you choose. You pay with your life, and dare I say, your soul. I don't expect non-religious people to run out and join a church to avoid being lonely. However, it might be good to know that some very encouraging stories of men and women who were abandoned and rejected by their families and community found refuge in their faith. That they didn't have to turn inward to carry the burden of the shame and hurt inflicted on them by others, that they can be forgiven and accepted for who they are. That God never changes. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that's the good news. With faith in God, you may be alone, but you'll never be lonely. This is Nia Gray with your Faith Report.
People make the world go round. People make the world go round. People make the world go round.
Our next guest is a dear friend to all of us, most of the time. He is he's the co-host of Weekend GMA, co-founder and host of 10% Happier, Dan Harris. And Dan recently dedicated an entire episode of his podcast to the issue of loneliness. Yeah. And so I know you've been speaking to experts about loneliness. What did you find out?
Well, first thing to note is that the thing we're all doing, hopefully, to keep ourselves safe, which is social distancing, can have an adverse health outcome, which is loneliness. And loneliness isn't just some mildly unpleasant state. If it goes on too long, if it becomes chronic, it can lead to health problems, like, as Dr. Jen would tell you, heart problems, depression, dementia, and this is if it goes on too long. So you really have to keep an eye on it.
No, it's a serious thing. And then there's the flip side. Many of us are experiencing the opposite of loneliness, cooped up with our families for far too long.
There was a record I used to listen to back in the 80s when I was into punk rock, and it was called You're Living All Over Me. And that is a sentiment that's come to mind occasionally, being cooped up with a five-year-old recently. But the truth is, actually, you don't have to be alone to be loneliness. Loneliness is a subjective state, not an objective state. And it really has to do with the quality of your relationships, not only to other people, but to yourself. And really, that's the key variable.
That is so true. So what do you do if you're feeling lonely?
Okay, so you got to work on the quality of your relationships. Mm-hmm. Just say you're cooped up alone or with people with whom you don't feel comfortable. You should make it a habit. And I talked to the former Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, about this, who's written a book about it called Together. His advice is every day do a call, preferably on video, to somebody with whom you have a good relationship. Work on that relationship. It can only be 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes. And the key is do not be distracted while you're doing it. Don't have your phone out. Don't check social media. Don't check email. And maybe even make a pact with other people on the call. We're going to pay attention while we're on this call.
Makes a lot of sense. The other thing you say to do is acts of service. Yes.
Well, see, the thing about loneliness is it throws you into a threat state where we're evolutionarily wired to feel under threat when we're alone. So we're going to focus on ourselves. The way to break yourself out of that threat state is to focus on other people. It reminds you of your value, and it connects you to other people. And that can be an incredibly helpful thing.
It certainly can. I always say the same thing to my kids, and it makes a big difference. And the final tip, it leads from there, is just to know that you're not alone.
We had a big loneliness problem in this country before COVID-19. Social distancing has put it on steroids. It's very easy to feel like everybody else is living their best life. If you look at social media, everybody's posting happy pictures. But the truth of the matter is loneliness already was a huge problem, and it's a huge problem now. And there's so much shame around it because loneliness tells you the lie that it's your fault, that you're unlovable. Mm-hmm. You got to get over that and reach out for help, because that is the answer.
And I found, just personally, and I think anecdotally from other people I've talked to, I'm hearing from friends I haven't heard from in years saying, let's Zoom, let's check in with one another. And that's what each of us can do. We can be the person to reach out.
I just called to say, love.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
Welcome back to Let's Talk About Race. Our topic is the physical and psychological violence in America as we approach the 2020 election. Now, listening to the news can be problematic, and living in Portland, Oregon, a systemically racist city which made national news for over 100 days of protests under the umbrella of saying Black Lives Matter. I'll tell you, 2020 is like living in the Twilight Zone, and turning on the news does not help.
There is a fifth dimension beyond what is known to us. It is a dimension as vast as space and as finite as time. It is the middle ground between truth and lies, between privilege and poverty, between power and helplessness. It lies beneath the fear of change and the summit of ignorance. You are entering the dimension of the imagination. Accept the fear. You are turning on the news.
To say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out, he's fired. He's fired!
Excuse me, sit down, you weren't called. Sit down, sit down, sit down. Go ahead. No, you don't, you haven't been called. Go back to Univision. Go ahead.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime. They're rapists.
I love the Mexican people in their spirit, but the country of Mexico is killing us. I want to build a wall.
We need the wall.
And Mexico will pay for the wall.
But we have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
You also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
She gets out, and she starts asking me all sorts of ridiculous questions. And, you know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
Well, we have some of the dumbest leaders in the world. We have losers.
Win, lose, or draw in this election, will you commit here today for a peaceful transferal of power after the election? And there has been rioting in Louisville, there's been rioting in many cities across this country, red and your so-called red and blue states. Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're gonna have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transferal of power?
We want to have, get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very peaceful, there won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it. And you know who knows it better than anybody else? The Democrats know it better than.
Coming up on Let's Talk About Race is our segment, Book Love.
H.P. Lovecraft, a viciously racist writer who died without fame or fortune in 1937, is blowing up right now. In fact, the year 2020 could be called a Lovecraftian year. His name is the title, and his books, his creative tropes in the genres of fantasy, horror, and science fiction intersecting with race are the subject in Lovecraft Country, the new HBO drama series co-created by a black woman, Misha Green. And Mr. Lovecraft might be horrified to know as well
that another black woman, N.K. Jemisin, is the most celebrated science fiction and fantasy writer of her generation, according to the New York Times. She is the winner of back-to-back Hugo Awards, the world's most prestigious science fiction award. Her newest novel, The City We Became, is the subject of our review for Book Love. The City We Became takes place in the present and is set in New York State, but there is still some world building necessary to help the reader imagine the concept of a city or parts of a city embodied by an avatar. One of Jemisin's characters explains, "This process, it happens all the time, all over the world, wherever there's a city. Enough human beings occupy one space, tell enough stories about it, develop a unique enough culture, and all those layers of reality start to compact and metamorphose. Eventually, when it's close to that moment, the city picks someone to be its midwife, champion, a person who represents the city and protects it as we do. But that person gets the job even before the city becomes something new. That person helps it happen." So the characters in The City We Became are avatars of the boroughs of New York. Manhattan is a young multiracial man with amnesia and a violent past. Queens is an Indian immigrant woman, a wife, mother, and a mathematician. The Bronx is an indigenous woman of the Lenape tribe, an art center administrator. Brooklyn is a black woman, a former rapper, a mother, now elected to city council. And Staten Island is a seemingly unconsciously biased young white woman raised by a stilted, submissive mother and an overbearing racist cop father. And the primary avatar who encompasses all of New York is a young homeless black man. So the surface story becomes, how do these very different personalities from extremely different lives come together to defend and save New York? Or is it even possible? While the antagonist, the enemy trying to take over and destroy New York, is allegorically white supremacy, and represented by a shape-shifting entity from another dimension who is always dressed in white and always a woman. The City We Became was not an easy 448-page read for me, and that's the reason I generally do not read science fiction. You have to not only work for it, but you have to wait for it, because so much of the story is innuendo, subtext, allegory. Sometimes what the text is saying is right in your face. Other times you can only really understand it when you're able to put the puzzle pieces together. I particularly want to push myself to read more in this genre because writers like N.K. Jemisin are doing important work, not only repairing some of the damage done by Lovecraft, who perceived and depicted fellow human beings as monsters, but Jemisin is writing exciting and bold work that has earned respect and reverence from a community not always welcoming to writers of color and women. And she did so on her merit as a writer who has mastered her craft. So while I have not earned the right to be as critical with The City We Became, it is the first in a trilogy, and I look forward to reading all three.
Hi, I am N.K. Jemisin, and this is my new book, The City We Became.
And I'm super proud of this book. This is my love letter to New York City, where I've lived on and off for a good chunk of my life. And in this book, the boroughs of New York and New York City itself come to life and are embodied in the forms of individuals. So imagine, like, if a single person represented the entire Bronx, or if a single person represented Manhattan. So these people come together, and they're going to have to do what they can to fight against a terrible ancient evil that has arisen and threatens the entire city. And you'll have to read it to find out what happens. So check it out. I hope you like it.
I came into this genre as a child. I slowly started reading my way through the classics or the canon that everybody recommended to me. At first, I did not understand the problem. And then as I grew older and more mature, I began to realize, oh, yeah, a lot of these are racist. And some other ists. They are part of the canon. A lot of my writing is in conversation with that canon. And so therefore, I feel the need to address it directly. I don't believe that, you know, people should not read these things. Obviously, there's some Lovecraftian influence, for example, in The City We Became. And you're not going to fully get that influence if you haven't actually read some Lovecraft. Now, that said, you don't have to read Lovecraft to fully enjoy it. It's just that, like, you need to understand that that's who I'm in conversation with. And Lovecraft, if you don't know, was ginormously racist, ginormously everythingist, anti-Semitic, even though he was married to a Jewish woman. The man hated, like, the Portuguese. I don't even really fully understand why. Anyway, so you don't have to read those classics unless you are planning to engage with the multiple layers of meaning that they have exerted upon the genre. I think there are enough new and good classics out there that you can skip them if you want. But in my case, I've chosen to engage with them and speak back to them through my writing.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yo, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
Don't punish me with brutality. Brother. Come on, talk to me. Brother. You can't see what's going.
New York Times columnist Tom Friedman has decades of experience covering leaders worldwide who try to stay in power. He's also the author of the bestseller Hot, Flat, and Crowded, Why We Need a Green Revolution and How It Can Renew America.
I began my career as a journalist covering Lebanon's second civil war and its history. And I'm terrified to find myself ending my career as a journalist covering America's potential second civil war in its history.
You really believe that?
Yeah, I think what happened in the last few days is a six-alarm fire. I think it's DEFCON 5. The President of the United States has told us either I win the election or I delegitimize the election. Those are your choices, folks. And he basically is trying to break people's will, to really get people to say, what the heck, he wants it so bad, just give it to him. I think this is certainly the most frightening moment in my life. It's frightening because of him. It's frightening because he's backed by a state-owned network. And it's terrifying because the Republican Party has become basically a political brothel that rents itself out by the night to whoever will energize its base, whether it was Sarah Palin or the Tea Party and now Trump. This is a party that went into its convention with no platform. No platform, and basically said, whatever Trump wants, we want. If you're not frightened now, if you are not terrified for what could happen, it's not we might have a disputed election. It is we are going to have a disputed election. almost certainly, unless Trump wins, in which case I shudder to think what 4 more years of this would be like.
Ooh, I felt that. All right, we need to grab Dad now.
Portland police now.
Oh, that's it.
This area is now a restricted access area, and all city parks are now closed. All people must leave the area immediately by traveling to the south. Failure to comply with this order will subject you to arrest.
We're in like City Hall.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroot News Northwest.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. We'll